FM 104.6, the heart of the island's community.
We've got special guests in the studio today. Before I introduce them, I just want to say a big thank you to Laura PC Wilcox for sorting this one out. She said, "Here, Mush, how would you like to talk about BBC, Marconi, and a lady called Phyllis Twigg on your radio programme, because there is a story that needs to be told, that it's already been told, but it was way, way, way back in time, I think as long as 1922, incredibly. So, without further ado, let's introduce our special guest without getting myself into trouble. It's Peter.
Peter, morning to you, Ian.
Thank you. Notice I didn't attempt your surname.
Yep. Peter Grimaldi.
Thank you. What was I saying?
I won't say it.
And we also have Karina. Hello, Karina. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, look, thanks for coming in. Someone said recently about stories, you know, about the Isle of Wight, so many old stories. Once they're gone, they're gone. Once we'd lose people and so on. So you coming in to tell this story is fantastic. It's already been told, but many years ago. But I've only got one question, really. Phyllis Twigg. Tell me about Phyllis Twigg.
Okay, where to begin? There's so much to tell about this remarkable woman. Should we start with our relationship to Phyllis? So I am Phyllis's great-granddaughter, and my father is her grandson. Phyllis moved to Ventnor back in 1912 when she married my great-grandfather, Dr. Garnet Twigg. They lived in Ventnor for several years, her very much as a doctor's wife. But frustrated by the challenges of World War I, her husband was serving as a doctor with the Royal Army Medical Corps away in Gallipoli. She turned to writing as a source of mental comfort. With her young daughter, Anne, my granny, she started writing children's stories. And happily, in 1922, she became the first radio playwright. So right at the very, very beginning of the BBC, it had only been up and running for a handful of weeks at that stage. And Dr. Arthur Burroughs was looking for his first radio play to really set alight the this new medium of broadcasting. And he chose Phyllis Twigg and her story, The Truth About Father Christmas, as a play for children to be broadcast at 5 o'clock on Christmas Eve, 1922.
Wow. I don't know where to start. I mean, obviously it's a Christmas story. The truth about it, is it, what sort of story is it? If it's the truth about, are we ruining it for young kids? Or?
Absolutely not. It's
thank God for that.
keeping the magic alive. So the story came about. It was inspired by a dream that her daughter Anne, my granny, had had. It was inspired by her daughter, who had had a horrid incident with a nasty boy at a Christmas party, who had said that was just a pretend man dressed up as Father Christmas, and little Anne wanted to know more. Phyllis, in her dream, had Father Christmas come to her and tell her how to answer this most challenging of questions. And she wrote a story about it, a story that was then published actually in the 1925 copy of the Normus Sunday books, which were designed so that each Sunday a child could read a special story. But before it was even published, it was, as I say, used as the inspiration for her radio play.
Wow. This is just an incredible... I can hear your voice and hear you telling the story. So maybe you ought to revisit this and re-record it.
Well, funny you should say that, actually. We did that very thing just before Christmas. So we collaborated with a London hotel, which is on the site of the original Marconi House, which was where the radio play was originally broadcast from back in 1922. It's now a hotel called Me Hotel. And they invited us in to collaborate with them at Christmas. And we did actually retell the story And
when you say we, did you?
So I played the part of Phyllis, telling the story as narrator. My daughter Flora, who's sadly at school today, so can't be here. She played the role of little Anne, my granny, having gone to the Christmas party and asked her mother all about Father Christmas. And then Paul Carenza, actually, who is a historian, broadcasting historian and writer. He played the role of Father Christmas. He is actually pretty instrumental to this whole story because it was he who discovered the link between Phyllis Twigg and another writer called Moira Main, who actually is Phyllis Twigg, but the connections hadn't been drawn for quite some time. He joined up the dots along with a chap called Professor Tim Crook and contacted our family a couple of years ago to basically unearth this whole story, to which we knew nothing about.
Wow. How does that make you feel, Peter?
I'm obviously very proud because it was my grandmother, and as we've only got a limited amount of time here, we better also tell you something else about her, which is she did the very first television cookery broadcast. So not only first radio broadcast, but the first television cookery broadcast on BBC television. And Karina will tell you about that.
Yes, so leaping forwards a little bit more into the 1930s. So having started with her radio play, she then moved into cookery and wrote a number of cookery books through the late 20s and 30s. One specifically for children, actually, so really combining her passion of writing for children with her passion for cookery. And it led to her being invited to Alexandra Palace, where the early days of the BBC television was setting up, and she was asked to come in and do a cookery demonstration. So she was the first TV chef offering quarter of an hour meals on the Primus stove. So, Jamie Oliver, eat your heart out.
I was just thinking of Jamie Oliver, and I would have coped with how things were back then. What was the first thing she cooked on this programme? Do you remember?
Tantalisingly, there are so few records from that time. We do have a photograph which we've been poring over in great detail to try to work it out. It was on a Primus stove, so the options were limited, but we can certainly see a decent pile of vegetables. In one photograph, we can see her grating the vegetables, and in another photograph, she is presenting a pie towards the camera. So some sort of pie, which is quite remarkable. But she was a really inventive cook. She was passionate about health, nutrition, diet. Her first book, in fact, which I'm holding here for you to see. I'm sorry, listeners, you won't be able to see it, but it's called Simplified Cooking and Invalid Diet. This one was published in 1928. And interestingly, sort of ahead of her name as Moira Main, it actually says a doctor's wife. So perhaps being a doctor's wife gave her that initial credential to be able to write this book, which is very much for invalids, but also for children, getting the right sorts of nutrition in. And she was inspired by her time in France as a young woman, where she had learnt from Chef Perrafitte, who was apparently the most magical and wonderful chef who had taken her under her wing and taught her the French cuisine. And she incorporates that into a lot of her recipes.
I must tell you, at this stage, Ian, one of my earliest memories of my grandmother was when she showed me a book called 101 Ways to Cook a Potato. And I had no idea there were that many ways, but it was exactly the sort of thing she absolutely revelled in. She didn't write the book herself, but she was very keen on that sort of thing.
Well, potatoes do feature in many of her cookery books. She's... she is absolutely evangelical about cooking them in their skins whenever possible to retain the nutrition that comes from within their skins. And indeed, for islanders, she recommends cooking them in seawater, so long as it's not polluted, she makes the point.
Yeah, probably less chance of pollution back then, but now, crikey, yeah, I wouldn't risk it. But I would imagine certain waters are fine.
The other interesting thing is we've got limited time in. I should tell you that as a doctor's wife, she was often having to go far beyond the normal call of duty. Nowadays, general practitioners tend not to be on duty at night, but in those days, my grandfather, Garnet Twigg, was on duty 24/7, and he told me the story whereby once he was called out in the middle of the night to a very distressed family where the child, aged 10, was dying of asphyxia because of diphtheria affecting the tonsils and the airway being closed up. And grandfather got there and realised the only way of saving this child's life was to do what's called a tracheostomy, which is make a small hole in the windpipe. And this is normally done under anaesthetic in a proper operating theatre. But my grandmother was there with him, and she was holding a mask on the child's face with dripping ether onto it while grandfather was doing the tracheostomy. Well, I've done this myself as an ear, nose and throat surgeon consultant several times, and I can tell you it's a very, very stressful situation, even under ideal conditions. And to carry that off, and the child survived all those years ago, and that's an example of what a remarkable woman Phyllis must have been to assist her husband in his general practice in the middle of the night, saving life.
What a story. Is that where the inspiration came from for you?
Well, I ended up as an ear, nose and throat consultant myself, and it was through my grandfather. My father, who was also a consultant ENT surgeon in the Isle of Wight, came to move to the island because he discovered there was a job coming up here in the Isle of Wight for a consultant ENT surgeon in 1947, just at the beginning of the National Health Service. And my pa was a surgeon from 47 to 77, and I took over after that. His name was Philip, I'm Peter, and the management committee realised that he wouldn't even have to change the names on the bedheads because it was P. Grimaldi. Big saving.
Great story. I like that. That's a really good story.
So 60 years continuously under P. Grimaldi, ear, nose and throat, Isle of Wight.
Is there another P. Grimaldi in the offing or not?
No, I've got no sons. I've got three daughters. Alicia, my eldest daughter.
Right.
Karina, my middle daughter, and Sophia, my youngest daughter. None of them are medics. Although Alicia did do a year of medicine at Cambridge University before she switched her course, realised she didn't want to be a doctor.
Okay, I want to take you back to meals, mealtimes. Right. I mean, if we were going to shed some light on this book, and the first thing, that you must remember certain meals that were cooked for you.
Well, my mother was a very good cook. She obviously inherited a lot of knowledge from my grandmother, but I was really quite young when my grandmother died, and I don't ever remember very much cooking. If it was, it was very informal. But my mother was a tremendous cook and was great at finding things in the fridge and making something out of whatever's left over. So I remember leftovers in our family was a very important part of our meals.
I know you've got an array of books there. Is there a leftovers book?
I was about to say that there absolutely is. I
mean, joking.
She goes long on cooking leftovers, but you must never cook the life out of your leftovers.
Right.
Keen to retain the nutritional content is her advice. She in her adventure book of cookery, which was the one that she wrote specifically for children. It may indeed be the first children's cookery book. There's a little bit of debate on that, but certainly it's the first children's book of its kind, which really goes into a lot of detail, really treats children as adults, but is also written with a lot of sort of magic infusing her words. Every chapter is written around adventures. In fact, again, for islanders, they might enjoy knowing that she features Isle of Wight ginger wine. She features Isle of Wight doughboys, which is essentially dumplings. I know Isle of Wight sort of donuts and Isle of Wight dumplings are very much traditional types of food, although she recommends that dumplings are grand food when taken with their right proportions of proteins and vitamins, but not otherwise.
Right, okay. was there the ginger wine, did you say? Was that an alcoholic one?
I think that is a non-alcoholic one, but I don't know specifically. I'll get back to you on that one. But yes, the books are riddled with tales of the Isle of Wight. She lived, as I say, in the beginning in Ventnor, but then moved to Cranmore near Yarmouth in
right.
the 30s.
Yeah.
And then latterly, post-war, to Newbridge. But she loves telling her tales of the island, folklore such as the Pied Piper of Newtown, who apparently precedes the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and lots of tales of fairies and mystical experiences, which she really believes in. She was very in touch with the spiritual world herself, and loved the mystical nature of the island.
How amazing. How amazing. Are any of the books still available?
It's a challenge. I mean, you sometimes get lucky on some of the eBays and Etsys, yeah. But nothing's still in print. The Adventure Book of Cookery and another book called The Magic Ring were published by the Oxford University Press, Simplified Cooking by Faber, but they're all out of print now. So you can get lucky from time to time.
And I don't suppose that the original recording, is that available or is that not?
It's not, because
how
in
sad.
Those, it's really sad. And if anyone listening does have any records, gramophone records lurking at home, look out for The Tales of the Fairy Dustman, which would be a wonderful gramophone record for us to get our hands on. But because she alongside her story writing and her cookery book writing, she also published a gramophone record back in the 1920s. So segueing from her Truth About Father Christmas radio play, she had a number of tales about the fairy dustman, which were broadcast on radio through the 1920s. There was a gramophone record with an accompanying book and even an accompanying nightlight. So she was quite into her sort of merchandise, even back in the 20s, all beautifully decorated with pictures of this fairy dustman, which is not, to point out, a binman-type dustman, but the magic man who comes around and sprinkles the fairy dust into the eyes of children as they sleep. She actually had an interesting newspaper article at the time where she's referred to as Mrs. Doctor, and that letters could be sent to her in Ventnor to her kind of story character, Puck the Painter, who was apparently a well-known addressee of Ventnor Post Office. And she really wrote these to help children who had fears, whether that was fears of coming in to see a doctor, such as she experienced with her husband being the Ventnor GP, or those who were scared of the dark. And so these stories about faith and hope and courage, these little sort of fairies called Fairy Faith and so on, really were designed to help children.
Wow.
I think I'm right in saying, Karina, that there is a book shortly to be published about iconic Isle of Wight women?
Yes, Lemon Jelly are working on a book about iconic women.
Because she really ought to feature in it. Let's hope she you can get enough information to them.
I hope they're listening, Peter.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, she really does deserve to go to be more known about by many people in view of the fact that she did so many amazing things which in her lifetime were not really written down and recognised. But I think there's a good book to be written there.
Well, let's hope so. I'm obviously working on her biography as well. But if anyone is interested to hear more, on Christmas Eve just gone, there was a radio show on BBC Radio 4 harking back to that original 1922 radio play that she wrote. It's called The Truth About Phyllis Twigg, and it's now available on BBC Sounds, starring Tamsin Gregg as Phyllis,
right,
Rory Kinnear as Arthur Burroughs, and actually my daughter Flora plays Little Anne.
Wow.
My mother.
What does that feel like when you're listening to something like that then?
Well, it's quite amazing. And it's all down to Karina having done the research on this and followed up to that inquiry by the BBC archivist, whose name I've forgotten.
Well, Professor Tim Crook and
yes.
Paul Carenza,
who kicked this off to
make the links between...
And then Paul Carenza came down to... Bembridge Fort recently because Bembridge Fort was doing some sort of a demonstration of Marconi's.
Paul came to talk about the early days of radio
in the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
And Paul Carenza. So he was instrumental in all this.
How brilliant. What an amazing story. Will you come back again?
We would love to.
Because I think we've only just scratched the surface, haven't we? We really have.
And well, next time I'll come more prepared with that Isle of Wight ginger wine recipe.
Well, don't just come with the recipe. Try and make some first. Bring some that's already made. But that would be really good. And maybe we could do a few podcasts on, record a few things as well. Because I think you're absolutely right. We've got to, otherwise we lose it, don't we? These are great stories. And what I got lost, I almost sat on the floor cross-legged when you started telling the story about, the being scared of the dark and those kind of stories. I'd love to go back to those kind of times sometimes because I think there's just so much stress in the world.
Well, we feel very lucky that Phyllis obviously loved writing, loved documenting, loved annotating. And she, we're very lucky that as we still... live on the Isle of Wight. We actually have all her books. We've discovered in a sort of dusty shelf her diaries that she had written during World War II, specifically for my father and aunt to read when they turned 21. So those were documenting her wartime life. We haven't even got onto her wartime experiences working with the Ministry of Food and living in a tiny little caravan in Berkshire. So a small breakaway from the Isle of Wight.
Lots to talk about.
More to talk about another time.
Well, the autobiography is fascinating because you say you're writing that, you're putting that together.
Yes.
That must be so fascinating, but so, I don't know, incredibly difficult as well because it's someone else. It's not, and I guess everything you see written down or other people's words, you have to piece it all together.
We do, and deciphering the handwriting is half the battle.
Oh, crikey.
So as I say, we're lucky that she documented so much about her own life, and it's almost like she's laid out some little clues for us through her diary, through her kind of annotations, through her cuttings. So we're having a lot of fun piecing the jigsaw together, and one clue leads to another. And yes, researching through newspaper archives, the British Library. It's been a lot of fun, but yes, it is a lot of hard work.
Oh, it must be. Honestly, it's an amazing story. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it. And I say, we've only just touched the iceberg, so you're tip of the iceberg, so you've got to come back again.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully between now and then, we should be able to find a few other bits and bobs, that gramophone record again.
Oh.
Just remind us what that was.
So it will be called The Tales of the Fairy Dustman, and it has a beautiful drawing of a fairy, Puck the Painter, on the front holding out a lantern.
It'll be a vinyl, an old-fashioned vinyl record, very brittle, and it'll probably be at 78 RPM. I think it was before the extended play records came out. So if anybody has got one or can find one, that would be a huge, huge find for BBC Archives as well.
Yeah. It's a shame they didn't keep all that. Because I know that there's an awful lot of stuff that they do now, and I would imagine there's easier ways of keeping things, and you don't want that stuff kept.
But
all of that amazing stuff that we've lost, or it's out there somewhere. Yeah. We just got to visit some old shop somewhere, haven't we? I think
that's it. And the BBC records, I mean, they didn't take any. They weren't equipped to be able to take recordings in those early days, and even things that did get recorded often in the war were recycled. So I think the first 10 years there are no actual records. Tantalisingly, her flat in London was bombed during the Blitz, which meant that the original manuscript for that first radio play was lost to me.
Oh, wow. Do you know, I'm going to ask, my mum's 92, and I'm going to ask, when I see her later today, I'm going to ask if she remembers Phyllis Twigg.
Yes.
Because I'm pretty sure when you just started describing the ginger wine, was it?
Mm-hmm.
My gran used to make ginger wine, and she used to make it a lot. And when you think back in the day, there wouldn't have been that many recipes out and about or accessible for people to get. So it quite possibly could have been, one of... Phyllis Twiggs.
Oh, so that would be a lovely connection.
I see her with her tights. I'm pretty sure she did all the stuff with tights, because you'd have to have the ginger and stuff, and you'd have to put it through, strain it, and so on. I'm pretty sure there were a pair of tights being used.
So, well, maybe we need to get your mum on the show as well.
Maybe that's a good idea. Yeah. Hey, look, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for coming in, Peter. And
delighted, and look for and good luck with your digital launch in April coming up. Is it the digital launch?
April the 18th.
Right, we shall be there, ready for the big switchover.
Yeah, it's going over. There's a bit of our technology going over your way, over Benbridge.
Great.
And I think what happens is that it goes up public knowledge, and people can complain about the size of the transmitter or not. So please don't complain about the size of the transmitter.
Right. Won't do.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.